Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Jennifer Zamparelli, 2FM. Good morning. So on this day in 1986 at 1:23 a.m., Reactor 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine exploded during a safety test. At one point, the disaster threatened all of Europe, but thanks to the efforts of hundreds of thousands of ordinary people, that fate was avoided. 35 years on, what is the situation in Chernobyl like now? Well, we asked our reporter Ryan Clark to have a look into it. Ryan, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Great to have you. Now, first off, can you take us back to 1986? How did this happen and how did we find out about it?
So the accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant is the worst nuclear disaster in human history. The Soviet Union's official death toll is only 31, with 28 of those being firemen who were forced on the scene. But you've got other estimates that range from 4,000 people all the way up to 93,000 people based on increased rates of thyroid cancer in the aftermath of the explosion. I think it's important to kind of set the scene. When Gorbachev came to power in 1985, the Soviet economy had completely tanked and was stagnant. So he had these goals to kind of kickstart it again. A lot of these goals were staked on technological advancements, particularly based on using nuclear energy to fuel them all. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where Chernobyl really comes into the picture, because Reactor 4 had just been built. And because of these economic plans, there was a goal to build a fifth and a sixth reactor in Chernobyl to meet these requirements. And if those two had been built, it would have been the biggest nuclear facility on Earth.
Wow.
But Reactor 4 at the time, it shouldn't even have been operational when it exploded. While it was being built, there was really big raw material shortages, and some of the materials that built the plants weren't up to what they should have been. But the demand for power at the time was so high that as it was ready to go, it was connected to the grid. I mean, like the safety test that did end in the disaster, it was just kind of viewed as a box ticking exercise. But when it did eventually happen on the 26th of April, it was only until a couple of days later on the 28th that because of some radioactive dirt on the shoe of a nuclear power plant worker in Sweden, that triggered alarms and detectors that the world actually found out about the disaster.
So the reactor explodes and starts spewing toxic radiation into the sky, which is obviously very, very bad. What is the impact in the aftermath of that?
So, yeah, it's not good at all.
Not like, great, Ryan.
I think it wouldn't be an understatement to say that in that moment, Chernobyl became the most dangerous place on Earth. The total amount of radiation that was released by the explosion was the equivalent of 500 atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima at the end of the Second World War. And that was just from 5% of the nuclear fuel that was in the reactor. Pripyat was the town that was closest to the plant at the time, and it was specifically built for the workers there. And there was so much kind of secrecy about what happened that it took 36 hours from when the plant exploded
and it was
for
just,
the evacuation
was it sheer,
order to be given.
Was it sheer embarrassment that it took so long? They were embarrassed that this had happened, that it took them so long to evacuate and make this public knowledge, so to speak?
It was common knowledge that these reactors they couldn't explode in the way that they did. So if the Soviet Union, because it was in such a bad state at the time globally, if they had to admit that this disaster happened and the reactor exploded so dramatically, it would be a massive hit to their standing in the world, which eventually happened in the end.
Talk to me about iodine tablets, which are used to help protect from thyroid cancer. They were not given to people either, were they?
No, they weren't. It comes back to the secrecy of everything that happens. The Soviet Union didn't want to admit that this happened. So they didn't give iodine tablets to people to protect them. I mean, you had winds that blew over Belarus from the explosion, and that contained an estimated 70% of the fallout. And it blew over Belarus. And to this day, there's about a fifth of the country's land that's contaminated and can't be used. I spoke to a girl, Julie Shinkarenka. Now, she was six at the time when the explosion happened. And she grew up in a town called Gomel in Belarus that was directly underneath one of the clouds. And she was able to tell me about the secrecy of everything that happened and how little the people actually knew. Like, she was able to recall that people were told not to panic, but they didn't know what they were not supposed to be panicking about. On the television, the news had a feature about something happened at the Chernobyl plant, but they didn't actually say what happened. The May Day parades that they usually have, because it's a holiday at that time of year, they just went on as if nothing had happened and people were out in this radiation. She told me that, like, one of the biggest contributors to people getting sick from the radiation was, you know, eating contaminated food and drinking contaminated milk, because people lived off the land.
Well, we do have a clip of Julie. Have a listen to this.
Everybody started to realize that something really going on, because people were complaining on constant dizziness, constant nosebleeds. And we know only now that that was only the beginning of the health crisis that engulfed our nation. It was absolutely crazy how many people had problems with thyroid glands, with bone structures, with their blood count. As a result of being exposed to such an amount of radiation, every member of my family had a problem with their health. I nearly lost my eyesight. I was extremely fortunate to get a treatment that lots of other kids were not able to get, and they had to suffer from such illnesses and disabilities.
I think we've all heard about children coming to Ireland from Chernobyl for rest and recuperation. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think this is a really good part about how Ireland helped out through all this. And we've always been at the forefront of helping people from Chernobyl and the region. Adi Roach, who is the CEO of Chernobyl Children International, she said that down through the years, Irish people have donated over like 100 million euro in aids to help the victims of the disaster. Now, all of this money would go towards regular supply convoys and surgical teams who would provide healthcare to kids and people there who wouldn't usually be able to afford that sort of healthcare, because Belarus is really very poor to this day. They also renovate buildings and facilities, because they want to build a network of these things called Homes of Hope. The aim there is to help disabled children and their families. When a child would reach their 10th birthday, they would be moved out of orphanages to other institutions. Now, this would typically be a boarding school, but you had some cases where kids would be moved into mental asylums.
That is just crazy. Raisa Carolyn is one of these children that CCI has helped, and this is her experience as a child growing up in an institution in Minsk. Have a listen to this.
The experience was very traumatic. Most of the time I'm just sitting around watching other people or children around me. Some of them are banging their heads off the wall, rocking back and forth, even though I was only there for a couple of months. But after I had left, I actually took up a really bad habit of rocking back and forth. And I know that I got that because of the mental asylum, because it's all that I was watching around me.
So not looked after during the disaster or in the aftermath of what's happened. Can you tell me more about her experience and how she eventually was adopted by an Irish family, wasn't she?
Yeah, it was a really long process for her. Her biological family in Belarus abandoned her in the hospital where Raisa was born, because doctors didn't think that she would survive for very long, unfortunately. So when her adoptive family met her for the first time, the Carolins, when she was six, they actually thought she was 3 years old because of how underdeveloped she had been. She had a lot of problems with eating and digesting food, and she had to walk on her knees because of her disabilities. But eventually, in 2002, when she was 10, the Carolins adopted her, completed the adoption process, and Raisa has lived in Trim in Meath ever since there. She's had around 30 operations, but she's very happy with how her life is now.
So I got my leg amputated when I was 12. My mother got me involved with the Irish Wheelchair Association, And I got into playing sports that way. And for years, actually, even after I got walking with my prosthetic limb, I still played wheelchair basketball. And I actually played fully able-bodied basketball as well in my local club. I think in 2009, when Ireland won the Grand Slam, I got really into rugby then. And I just thought it was the most amazing thing ever. They established this new team, the Wheelchair Rugby Sevens. And we basically incorporate everything that you play on a field, but you just play in a wheelchair on a kind of an indoor arena as such. And it's great. I love it. So I've been playing with Ireland for a couple of years.
Good honour. Now, for a lot of people, their first exposure to what happened in Chernobyl would have been the Sky HBO series from a few years ago. What has the show's impact been, though?
Yeah, I think it's right to say that, like, for a certain generation of people, that series would have been their first real insight into the devastation that the disaster caused. Like, I even have noticed from my own friends that some of them, they would have known that something happened in Chernobyl maybe, but nothing more than that. They watched the series then and they realized the suffering that happened as a result. But yeah, but the sudden boost in popularity again has been a bit of a double-edged sword.
Why is that?
It's understandable why people would want to go and visit Chernobyl. And it's mostly safe now, but it's still possible to run into radiation hotspots if you're not careful.
Yeah, Adie Roach thinks that disaster tourism is disrespectful to people who left their homes and were not able to return. Have a listen.
Like people that are on a bus tour all over Europe, like today it's Pompeii, tomorrow it's the Colosseum in Rome, or then it's Dachau, and then, well, today it's Chernobyl. Now, I have a huge problem with that, because the first thing I would say is this was a terrible tragedy that happened there. Like, this site remains really a place of death and a place of mass displacement. And I know from talking to the refugees from Pripyat, they often cry their eyes out saying, I saw somebody tramping around my living room. What do they add to the place? Nothing. But they take something away from the soul of the place, which really should be left as a monument to man's destructive capabilities.
Absolutely. Now, these days, climate change is having an effect on everything. But what is the situation like over there?
So, yeah, it's definitely been having an impact in Chernobyl too. There's always kind of been forest fires around Chernobyl, but they're happening more frequently now because of climate change. And they're happening in areas that contain more radioactive fallout. At the time in 1986, radiation would have been absorbed by the trees and the ground. So when they all catch fire and burn, that radiation is released again. Then you've also got river dredging. That's another way for the radiation to be re-released. There's a planned massive canal to be built between the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea. But the issue is that it'll pass through the Pripyat River, which is only 2.5 kilometers from the power plant. I spoke with Jan Haverkamp. He's a senior expert in nuclear energy for Greenpeace. And he told me that this could potentially destroy vast ecosystems and store up, you know, radioactive sludge that was on the bottom of the river after the explosion. And it could contaminate drinking water for millions of people.
So 35 years later, Ryan, they still haven't been able to clean it all up, basically.
No, see, that's the big issue with this. You can even see this with Fukushima in Japan. That's the second worst nuclear disaster in human history, and that only happened 10 years ago. But we haven't come up with technological solutions to fix these problems. So it comes down to, we just have to contain it until we eventually discover some scientific methods of getting rid of it all.
Scary, so scary. Ryan Clark, thank you so much for that report, and I'll chat to you soon.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, Ryan. Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.